feels a little bit like fall is in the air, and another indicator of the changing of the seasons would be our songbirds thinking about heading south for the winter. I'm Lee Rayburn, and that's where we start today with our guest, Bill Volkert. Bill is a retired wildlife educator, naturalist. He worked at the Horicon Marsh State Wildlife Area for 27 years and knows birds better than just about anybody. So if you have a question about the birds you've been seeing, some of their behavior or calls, if you'd like to try to mimic one, join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you'd like help in identifying a bird and you've snapped a picture, you can send it to us along with your questions. Email talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. And Bill, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much, Lee. Great to be back.
And I love seeing the world through your eyes, because your eyes are always looking up towards the skies. You're always listening to the birds. And this is the time of year where we're starting to hear it quiet down a little bit.
Yes, it is. This is the time where things are really starting to change. And different birds, of course, migrate at different times. So when we talk about migration, it already begins in February when Canada geese and red-winged blackbirds begin to move. It winds down as we get to the latter part of May, when the nighthawks and the cuckoos are the last to arrive. And it starts up again as we get into the latter part of July. The first shorebirds will show up from the Arctic. Mm-hmm. And now in August, we're starting to see the first real movement. Interestingly, the last birds to arrive are the first to leave. So
really?
They have the shortest amount of time. Well, it's because what drives the migration is food. And so Canada geese, they just simply are feeding in the uplands and are really discouraged or lack access to food with snow cover. So it's a short time of the year when we really have a lot of snow. But if you're an insectivore like the songbirds, it's a much shorter season before it warms up, the insects hatch, and then before we get the frost again. So migration really takes up, when we look at the whole family of birds, most of the year. I like to focus on the songbirds, where really we have the first arrivals in that latter part of April. May is the real peak. June is nesting. Uh-huh. July is the fledging season. The young are coming out of the nest. Now August, this is the flocking season. So the birds are no longer tied to that nest site and that very local movement to care for the young. Now they begin to move. The young are full grown, and this is when they start to move to areas of good feeding and abundant food sources. So the flocks will start to form. And this is also where the first birds start to not only locally shuffle and move, but we also see the beginning of the migration. Last night, we apparently had a pretty good movement of birds with a north wind. So we see the first actual exodus of some of the early songbirds. And about 3 days ago, I saw the first nighthawk already starting to move around a little bit. And a few of them are going to be heading out. And over the next 2 weeks, we'll see the big nighthawk movement.
I told you that I had a squirrel yelling at me the other day, wondered what was going on, and saw a hawk land on the wire in my neighborhood. Hadn't seen one all season. Could that be part of the migration?
No, that's probably the Cooper's hawk.
Okay.
Or red-tailed hawk are the two most common in the area, and those are always going to be a threat for, especially for the smaller rodents. A nighthawk, actually, it's not a hawk. It's in the what's called the nightjar family, or the old name was goat suckers. And there was an old myth that they milk the goats at night.
What?
I don't know where these names came from.
I'm glad we updated the names.
But it's related to the whippoorwill.
Oh, okay.
Which is actually a very large family of birds around the world. And I think the more desirable name is the nightjars. Because they feed in the evening and they have this very large bucket-like mouth, a very tiny bill, but when they open the mouth, it's just a huge gape. And that's for the large insects and moths that they're scooping out of the air.
Before I get to Julie's call here, I also thought I saw a mottled robin on my fence the other day. Like, it looked like a baby robin, and I thought it's a little late in the year to be having baby robins, but if they're here year-round, it's probably fine, right?
Well, robins will have a few that stick around in the wintertime, and it's mostly a trade-off. Do they try to just tough it out, or do they use that energy reserve to migrate and depart, which the vast majority do? Robins can have more than one brood, and so this is probably a second nesting, or at least nesting attempt if they lost the first nest.
Sure, but this is a baby. I think it's not really ready to head south for the winter anytime soon.
Yeah, and there's sometimes, again, that trade-off. Can you pull off one more family, and are you going to be lucky that they will mature and be able to move? And I think for some of these birds, it's better if they're able to try a second time, give it a shot. They may or may not survive. In a sense, it's the same strategy that owls use. Owls will lay commonly 3-4 eggs, but they don't expect all the young to survive because they never know what that rodent population will be by the time the young hatch out and demand food. And so there's always an insurance policy. If you all of a sudden you realize later in the year that it's a big rodent explosion in the population, too late to start again.
Right.
So, you know,
it's better to have more.
Exactly.
I mean, it's cruel to us, but as a survival technique, it makes natural sense.
That's just what I was going to say. Yeah, it seems kind of cruel to us to raise some of them and just let them die. Or even worse, sometimes the siblings will eat their brothers or sisters. Now there's a dysfunctional family. But there again, it's that insurance policy that at least somebody will survive, and it'll be, you know, the strongest and healthiest out of the population.
And this migration's a quiet migration. Unlike the spring where the birds are coming up and they are singing, they're full-throated and letting it rip, this time they seem to be rather subdued.
And unless you're really looking for the birds, this is a somewhat unseen migration, or as I refer to it, the silent procession of birds. So in springtime, when the songbirds in particular arrive, you notice the first oriole that it's in your backyard or in the neighborhood.
Hear it before you see it, probably.
Yeah, bright colored. The leaves are barely emerging, so they're very visible, and they're singing, and they're in that breeding plumage. In fall time, we actually right now have more birds than we have in spring because we've added all those young for the year, and yet we see them less frequently.
And it's quieter.
Yeah, it's quieter. They're not singing because they're not defending territories or looking for mates. They're not producing the full song. It's just the call notes to keep the flock together, communicate, and when they're, of course, in flight, to stay together. And a lot of the birds are already molting into that winter plumage, so they're losing the bright colors. And the other problem is the leaves are still full on the trees.
Sure.
So these little 4 or 5 inch birds up in the treetops, they're really hard to see. And you've really got to get out there with your binoculars and intentionally look for them to see what's going on. The other thing that we have is it's really easy if you're keeping track of the phenology of birds. In other words, the dates that they arrive. You know, the first day you see something that comes in. It's really hard to know the last day when they've departed because that's always in retrospect. You'd have to keep daily records and then look back and realize, oh, it's been 2 weeks since I've actually seen one of those. Is that just simply because they're hidden in the leaves and you didn't notice it, or did they actually depart? So it's always a little guesswork roughly about the time that we've seen the last ones that have moved out.
You make me appreciate fall that much more, Bill. There's more birds now than there are in any time of the year here. And as they get ready to migrate south, they're beginning to flock in what you call the silent procession. And I like that very much. It feels a little bit like fall. Let's go to your questions now for our guest, Bill Volkert, our aviary expert, 1-800-642-1234, or email talk at WPR.org. And we'll start with Julie in Monona. Hi, Julie.
Can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Okay. I've put up 2 hummingbird feeders on either side of a fairly large deck. And in my backyard, I've got wildflower gardens. Now, we've got at least 4 different hummingbirds visiting the feeders. And my question is, some of the hummingbirds are little and they don't seem to get chased away by the larger one. A larger one will watch them. And if 2 of the larger ones show up at the same time, they dive bomb each other. Am I looking at family groups or 2 different species?
Well, we mostly have 1 species of hummingbird in Wisconsin. That's the ruby throat. We will, on occasion, especially this time of year, we'll see, we'll get a few reports or records every so often of western hummingbirds. The rufous hummingbird is one of the more common ones from out west that may travel into Wisconsin on its way south. Anna's hummingbird has been sighted on occasion every few years, but I would say 99.9 plus percent of our hummingbirds are going to be the ruby throat. Now, you said the larger ones, there's not much difference in size, but the male has that brilliant, bright red throat, the ruby throat, or when he turns away from the light, looks black, makes him look a little bit larger in size. And the young ones right now are all full grown. They look pretty much like the females. And yeah, those are the young or females that are coming to feed. They will sometimes share the feeder, but the males are very defensive over a food source.
Hmm.
And so if another male in particular tries to come in, yeah, they'll drive them out. Or sometimes any other hummingbird, I'll get them fighting over my feeder. And I'll see them just do laps around the house where one of them is just chasing somebody else off because that is his food source. Whether he's actually drinking from it right then or not, he's defending it. So, yeah, those little hummingbirds can get quite aggressive.
I don't think of hummingbirds as possessive until you see them fighting over hummingbird feeder.
Yeah, and especially if you get out into the wild where you have a big flowering a group of plants that are desirable for them, those birds will just guard them fiercely. And, it's really quite interesting how fast they are zipping around, chasing each other out, and then displaying for the defense of that food source of theirs.
So as opposed to family or types of hummingbirds, it's more likely this is a gender dynamic?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. It's more likely yet that those are young ones that were locally hatched out. Mm-hmm. But as I said, this is that flocking season. There's a mixture out there. So the birds are moving around.
Oh.
So
where are hummingbirds this time of year in terms of heading south for the winter?
Well, there again, you'd have to mark individuals to know who's who, and you'd have to be able to see that. And that's the problem for hummingbirds. There's no way to easily mark them that we can capture, without capturing them, to identify them. Songbirds, we use color leg bands.
Sure.
So that without having to catch the birds, you can then look from a distance and identify individuals. You just can't do that on those short legs of hummingbirds. So there's always a little guesswork of who's who. More likely, this is a locally hatched family. But there is that time of year now where they're free-flying and there could be a shuffle. So it's hard to say if that isn't a bird that maybe came from somewhere else. And as things are we're getting into the cooler nights and we're sort of anticipating the eventual food shortages, maybe some of the northern hummingbirds are moving in. Again, who's who out there?
Yeah.
We don't know if they all look alike. So there's a little bit of uncertainty.
Julie, I think you're lucky. I only had one hummingbird that I saw all summer, but just seeing one that's enough, and I very much appreciate the call. We'll go to Janet in Iron Ridge next. Janet, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is on my favorite birds are the phoebes and the peewees and the flycatchers, and all summer long, enjoy listening to them. And the month of August, I have more bugs in my yard than I do in June. And I would say all my flycatchers, like the great crested flycatcher and the phoebe, they're all gone. And I was wondering, you know, you said there was August is the month for flocking, but was just wondering how, as they're flocking for the fall, if they're still feeding on so many flies and mosquitoes, you know, that I have more in August than I do in June.
You'll also notice, and I'll get off the subject a little bit and come back to it, but you'll notice that as we get into September, the swallows will start to really concentrate heavily, and then they're going to be heading out, and we're going to have some really nice Indian summer days yet.
Sure.
And may even have a mosquito hatch yet. And you'll wonder, so why did those birds leave so early? They can't wait till the last day that we get that first killing frost, and all of a sudden, overnight, the fruit is gone.
It's too late.
So they have to anticipate that.
Yeah.
And so what you have is perhaps already, we had, as I said earlier, a movement of birds last night. Some of them could have departed as early migrants, or they may have just moved around locally. They're no longer tied right to that territory where they nested for the summer, your backyard or neighborhood. And so there's a little bit of that shuffle. And I've had this experience in the past where somebody will talk about all their birds seem to be gone. And then next thing you know, the next person is saying, I've never seen so many. So there's a little bit of that local movement of birds as well. And as I said earlier, of course, with the leaves out there and the birds not calling as frequently, they may be silently overhead. I heard a couple calls of orioles, which were so loud around my neighborhood over the summer. They're still there, but they're not calling as frequently, and I don't know how many are there because they're up in the treetops where they're not that visible.
So it might not be that the Phoebes and flycatchers have all gone. It might be that they've moved on to another local area.
Yeah.
I think the tough part is there's still too many bugs.
And nobody to eat them.
Janet, thank you for the call. Let's go to Marlene in Ladysmith next. Marlene, hi.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I have two questions. The first one is hummingbirds. They're starting to sell more and more hummingbird houses, but I'm not seeing any hummingbirds moving into them, and I was told that they don't really go into houses. They make their own. And the second question is, we have a small park with a little pond, and we have a problem with geese. All over the place. You can't hardly have your kids down there. Is there a decent way to get rid of them?
Well, good questions. Yeah, the hummingbird house is just a gimmick. They build a little nest. They're not going to use it. And it's also, I've seen some very fancy, very ornamental hummingbird feeders. That's, again, to sell it to people. Hummingbird doesn't care. So just simple sugar water. Don't get the colored stuff. Don't get all the prepared stuff. That's really
just
unnecessary.
Water.
Yeah, just sugar water. Just a.
I thought the red attracted the hummingbirds.
Well, red does, but okay. Oftentimes the feeders will have that anyhow on it.
So as long as the feeder's red, then
yeah. And the food coloring really doesn't add anything to the bird, or for its diet. So
sure.
Yeah, they're probably trying to sell more to people than they are to try to benefit the hummingbirds. So, yeah, it gets to be a little gimmicky. And a hummingbird house, no, they build a tiny nest. They're not going to use it. And, yeah, you can put that out in your backyard, and it'll look nice, but it's not going to attract anything.
As for the geese.
Yeah, Canada geese, especially in urban, suburban areas, that's always been a challenge as these populations have built up. The thing to keep in mind, like all birds, they are federally protected. So with that, without special permits, there's nothing that you can do to harass or discourage or remove those birds. On a community level, cities and townships have been able to apply for permit to either they can oil the eggs so they're not hatching any more young. They have done roundups of them to relocate them, or even in the past they used to process them as food. That became somewhat unpopular among people. I don't know how much that program is still ongoing.
Is the permitting through the DNR, Bill?
It's Fish and Wildlife Service.
Fish and Wildlife Service.
Because they're
Service.
Federally protected.
U.S. Fish and Wildlife.
Yes.
All right.
So you would have to do that. The problem with, say, oiling eggs so they're not successfully nesting in the year, you are already trying to do something when the population is a nuisance. So you're just keeping it from getting bigger. Relocating the birds, well, they're your problem, and now you're giving it to somebody else. The most effective thing for a Canada goose population management is regulated hunting. The problem, of course, is you cannot legally discharge firearms within city limits, and so that's not an option. And I've written extensively about it. This is really a big problem. And what it comes down to is it's not a wildlife management problem. If you have too much wildlife, there's a lot of simple ways to manage them. It's a social political problem. I don't mean to be cruel about this, but I can give you a dozen different ways to kill a Canada goose. That's easy. To do it in a socially acceptable manner, however, especially in an urban suburban landscape where it's very visible, are people going to buy into it?
How can we humanely deal with this population? And from the perspective of the geese, we're the problem here, not them.
Right.
You know, we're the one encroaching on their nests, on their babies, on their families. And what can Marlene do?
Well, you have to work with your local community and the Fish and Wildlife Service and go through the DNR. They would be the first ones to approach, but it would be a federal permit that they could issue to you. But they also will put sideboards on just what are the options.
I thought Canadian geese weren't necessarily interested in settling down near us. And so if we have a presence there or if we have a dog that goes out in the yard, the geese aren't likely.
They're pretty tolerable.
Really?
And, you know, the other problem, as you said, we're encroaching on their territory. It's even a little more than that. We've created good habitat for them. And the way we've done this is really through the urban, suburban sprawl that we've seen, that kind of landscape. Canada geese, They like water, which is places to escape to from predators for safety, and they're an upland grazer. Grass or any other wild vegetation is a major food source
for them.
Plenty
of grass in the suburbs, Bill.
So, yeah, that's what you have. You have your golf courses, your parks, and even these retention ponds with grass around it and lawn grasses and so forth. That's ideal goose habitat, and we have made a de facto refuge because we cannot hunt them, and they are fairly tolerable of people. So we really can't easily discourage them from these areas. And in more aggressive manners, that, of course, requires a federal permit. So that becomes a management challenge of how do we do it in a manner that is going to be acceptable and, of course, now permitted. But yeah, go contact the local DNR, work with your community, see if there is some sort of permit that you can get for that. There are means to do this, but you've got to go through some hoops.
And those means might have some political and social ramifications.
Well, and the problem is when you do it, say in a larger community, you'll have a public hearing.
Yeah.
And we've been at those in the past, and that's the problem right there. That's what I mean by being not a wildlife problem, but a social political problem. And so you end up with almost two factions. Some people just kill them all. I don't care. Get rid of every goose. And other people, no, they're not
save
a problem.
Every goose.
Save them. And let's come to agreement. So that becomes the difficult challenge then.
Marlene, I'm sorry. This is a bigger problem than just Canadian geese. I apologize. I got a picture here in the studio. Bill, Denny and Middleton emailed it to us. What kind of stress caused this is his question. He named this bird Anakin after Darth Vader when he takes his helmet off. He says it's kind of a pathetic appearance. It looks like it's kind of a blurry picture, but
yes,
the bird looks like it's bald on top.
Yep.
Doesn't have any feathers on it around its head.
And this is very typical. Cardinals seem to be the most susceptible. It's feather loss.
Is it disease?
And particularly, well, there may be multiple causes for this. Could be some stress and kind of compromised health for the bird. Feather mites is another possible cause for it. And basically, it's more as an aesthetic problem. And yeah, some of them can look pretty ugly when they lose all their feathers around their head. This guy does not look...
That's when you realize that they're ancestors of the dinosaurs, because you take those feathers off and it looked like a Jurassic Park movie.
Yeah, it's a pretty pitiful looking bird. The biggest problem there is the feathers are insulating. Cardinals don't migrate. So if you have extensive feather loss through the winter time, that can be a problem for the birds. Otherwise, it's really more, as I say, it just looks bad.
You said they were molting and getting their winter coats on or winter feathers on?
Well, this is
on.
Not molting.
Right, but would the molt, could they regrow
their
feathers?
They could regrow, yeah. And what you have is a regular molt going between the heavy down feathers for winter and that what we think of as winter plumage, the non-breeding colors. And then you also can have kind of an emergency feather growth. If a bird loses a feather, it's damaged throughout the year. They can always regrow them because they need them. So it depends on whatever the cause was here, how extensive that is for the bird to be able to regrow those feathers again.
But it's not male pattern baldness in a bird. This
no.
is something... This is like mites or...
Yeah, it could be feather mites or other kinds of stress or underlying problems. We're Denny just seeing the symptoms.
Yeah, Denny... Okay, it's the symptom, not the disease. Denny says he's been seeing this bird around his house all year, so it sounds like it's been pretty chronic.
Pretty persistent problem, yeah.
Bill Volkert is our guest. We're talking about birds this hour and want to invite you to our conversation. You can send us a picture like... Denny did of his Darth Vader cardinal by emailing us talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. If you have any question about birds you're seeing around Wisconsin or would like to try your hand at a bird call, you're welcome to join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Bill's a retired wildlife educator and naturalist. Worked at the Horicon Marsh State Wildlife Area for 27 years, and we do have a question from Sumner here about the Horicon Marsh that we will get to when we continue. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to WPR News. songbirds are starting to flock, and fall migration is almost at hand, and it is an indicator of the changing of the seasons. We are talking about the beautiful birds of Wisconsin this hour with our guest Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator and naturalist, worked at the Horicon-Marsh State Wildlife Area for 27 years, and he's answering your questions, your calls, your emails, and let's get right back to it now with Lee in Green Bay. Lee, hi.
Yeah, I just want to make a comment and a question. I've got, my house sits on about 20 acres here. I've got partially wooded, partially field. Sunday night, I had such a nice flock of the bird that you say is a nighthawk, mm-hmm. correct? There must have been 20, 25 of them mm-hmm. towards dusk. Really nice thing to see. And I'm also, I'd like to ask how are whippoorwills doing in the state? I don't hear them anymore like I used to. You know, that's kind of a thing of the past. And one more thing I'd like mm-hmm. to say to the listeners, don't let your cats run loose. Bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And information came out from the Canadian Wildlife Service that their assessment for the birds of Canada, that the number one human-caused mortality factor is feral and free-ranging cats. And it's one of the simple things we can do. Just, don't let cats outside, because it is a non-native exotic predator that birds just have no ability to deal with, and it has a serious impact.
Well, from a conversation we had a few weeks ago, one is keeping your domestic cats inside. Two
right.
is dealing with the feral cat
right.
population, and
yeah.
that is something that largely goes unaddressed, and it's those feral cat cats that I would imagine wandering Canada that could be a problem. And if mm-hmm. if we found a way to deal with them in a population control, it's kind of like Canadian geese. It becomes a social political
exactly.
issue as much as a wildlife issue.
Right. And of course, because cats are considered pets, even if they're free ranging feral cats, there's that humane treatment. And then there's a problem. You do take them in. They're not accustomed to people.
Yeah,
how
they don't
do you
want
adopt
anything
them?
To do with you.
You have basically a wild animal, and you can't just confine and keep a big holding pen of hundreds and hundreds of cats. So how do we manage that? It's a problem we created, and quite honestly, it's a problem that we're going to have to solve, especially since birds are in trouble from a lot of other different impacts, and this is just one of many different.
Now, I'm not advocating murdering cats.
Right,
There is trap, neuter, return programs that can limit the population, and you can begin to control it that way.
Well, the problem with that is you still have the cat outside
for the rest of its life.
Yeah.
But it's the mating. You can't
yeah.
you can't kill the problem. If that were the case,
yeah.
we would have killed it by now, because
right.
we're killing 3 to 5 million of these animals every year already. How many more do you want to decimate? There's got to be a solution to this problem that makes sense for everybody.
Well, then the biggest problem is that oftentimes people come at this like they do in a lot of things on a more emotional level than
sure.
a rational level. And yeah, cats certainly, people do warm up to them. And so then it becomes really hard to come up with an agreeable solution when people feel so attached
but
and very emotional.
But feral cats never warm up to humans. They are, like
no.
you said, they are wild animals.
Yes.
So they should be treated as such.
And
but
like,
they're invasive wild animals.
Exactly. Yeah, it is an invasive exotic species. Mm-hmm. And as I said, it's becoming a real dangerous world for birds. We've seen tremendous declines. We've lost
natural habitat.
Well, a lot of factors out there. And this is just one other one, and probably one of the easier ones to address. The other question was on whippoorwills and how are they doing, and he doesn't hear them anymore. And yes, that's a bird that is in serious decline. We still have them in Wisconsin, but they've sort of retreated to the central and west central part of the state. I would hear them in other areas, one or two birds. And this was in the past when the population was healthy enough that what was considered prime habitat was basically saturated, and these were birds spilling over and trying to find more a mate and a place in somewhat marginal, remote areas outside of that core area of the population. Well, as the population declines, they essentially retreat to that core. And the caller here from the Green Bay area, mm-hmm. Those are, again, birds that in the past, when there were plenty of them, were moving out to there. And, yeah, it's getting silent. You can still find them in a few places. There are some good spots in Wisconsin, but it's a much more restricted distribution than it was in the past because it's a smaller population.
When we have discussions with our entomologists on the air, we always get the stories about the windshield effect, that we're not seeing the insects that we used to see, that these birds have a diet largely of insects, and we're seeing less insects. We're seeing less natural habitat. We're seeing more predators. We're seeing a real squeeze on the bird population from a number of different places. But is the diet and the amount of insects part of that?
I'm sure it's a serious contributing factor. And so here's one of the problems in bird conservation is, first, what we do is we monitor their populations to see how many there are and how well they're doing. What is the trend over time? Is it maintaining itself? Are they increasing and recovering? Or are they declining? If we start to detect declines, now it becomes complicated. What is the cause? And as we've already alluded to this, there are oftentimes multiple factors. Which are the ones that have a large impact that we can easily resolve? And quite honestly, when we look back at the declines of eagles and ospreys, that was a little bit of an exception because that was a straight cause and effect. It was DDT resulting in eggshell thinning, resulting in inability to rear young and populations declining.
And when it was that easy, it was pretty...
One chemical, there it is, they're back. Now we have multiple factors. So it's the window collision, sterile, the roaming cats. We have tropical rainforest loss. We have habitat loss here, pesticides and chemicals, environment, insect declines. What is the biggest impact for which group of birds and how do we address it? It's a very multivariate, very much multiple factors that are affecting them.
I hear this all the time, Bill. No silver bullet.
Yeah, there
it's
is
buckshot.
No. Yeah, there's no simple solution, but we have to do something if we're going to keep the birds here. Mm. And as I always remind people, and I usually like to close with this line, is that you know, we are the source of all the environmental problems.
There is only one problem. It is us.
Yeah, but there's also a little bit of an optimism. We are also the only solution. We're the ones who are going to have to solve that. And as we're dedicated enough, I'm sure we can. We've got to do it before it gets too late, before these birds do disappear.
Lee, thank you so much for the call. And Bill, I appreciate that perspective. We'll go to Jolie and Mozanine next. Jolie, hi.
Good morning. A question I would like to ask is the smoke fire, or the fire smoke, how did that affect the bird migration and the bird's health?
That's a good question. The smoke, of course, we can see that can drift for a long distance. And as birds are migrating, they may encounter that. For the most part, I would think that like a storm system, birds should be able to fly around that. But there was an unusual instance, I believe it was just last summer. There were swallows that literally fell from the sky. They got into a heavy smoke and they were just choking to death, literally. And they were dropping out of the sky, apparently could not fly around it. It was pervasive and thick enough that it was actually impacting them. My other concern is, besides the short-term event of smoke in the atmosphere, is the loss of millions of acres of habitat. Yes, it will regrow again, but considering that birds are under so many pressures, especially with the habitat loss and constrictions of it, we have taken a lot of acres out for, say, the next several years before that starts to regrow. And also what we've done is we've converted that from a mature forest stand into what will now be brush and shrubs. So one group of birds are going to benefit. Mm-hmm. They're going to get that early growth of succession in the next few years as those forests recover. But we've also now taken away for those forest interior birds the large swaths of habitat. And that, again, adds to the whole conservation concern here.
It feels like forest fires have become an annual event to some degree, or the smoke from forest fires in Wisconsin at some point is going to hit us during the summer months. And if it hits us, it's hitting our birds. And
it's making a more unhealthy environment for everyone, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Jolie, thank you for the call. Kaya in Madison, you're next. Hi, Kaya.
Hi. I was up around Barron, Wisconsin, visiting some friends. They live in a on the edge of a lake, little lake. We were on the deck, and they had a hummingbird feeder out. And a hummingbird feeder flew up to it, and I thought, oh, that's a beautiful. Oh, wait a minute. That's not a hummingbird. It was a hummingbird. It came back again and again, but it was not colored like a ruby-throated hummingbird. It was black, with an orange neck. And I said, huh, my husband, did you see that? And he said, yes. And the homeowners, they don't pay attention to the color of the bird. I came home, I looked up in all the books, and no, not any hummingbird colored like that. Is there an explanation for a hummingbird that is, that could be, I'm astounded.
Okay, I'll take a guess at this. You mentioned orange. You said it was restricted to the throat, but as I mentioned earlier, one of the more common Western hummingbirds that we'll see in Wisconsin is the rufous hummingbird, and it gets its name because it is sort of a reddish-brown color. If you saw it just in the throat, I'm wondering if that isn't a young male that is just starting to get it that adult plumage. And so it's not just that it's not complete plumage, but oftentimes for hummingbirds also some of that has iridescence to it, mm-hmm. and the lighting that you get, the angles, we may not see all of the color. So as I say, a little bit of a stab here, but I think you probably have a young male rufous, and that's always a worthwhile sighting in Wisconsin.
And a rare one.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're getting a little bit increasing sightings of that bird, and the question is it first of all that we're having more birds showing up, or do we have people who are reporting them more? So there's a little bit of that observer bias could be part of it. We don't know in the past how many were coming from the report. We just know the number of reports.
I got to say, I like the idea that we're paying more attention to the birds and we're looking closer at them and we're identifying them. And we've got these tools now that help us identify them. We've got apps for that.
And I think that's really been a big aid.
Yeah.
I used to get a lot of phone calls from people that at least knew to contact DNR for wildlife questions. But it's only those individuals who are curious enough and going to take the time to do it. And, you know, when I look back, I always found it interesting that some of the rarest bird reports in Wisconsin always were in the backyards of some of the best bird watchers in Wisconsin. They reported the first of this and that.
How do these bird watchers attract all these rare
exactly.
birds?
The golden crown sparrow from out west. It shows right up in a bird watcher's backyard. The first report of the house finch back in the 70s showed up in Milwaukee at one of our prime bird watchers. Well, that's because they knew and everything else went unreported.
Yeah.
And I think here we've increased the awareness by providing these tools and a network for people. Take a picture now. And you can share it, you can use an app. And with that, I think we're getting a better reporting from people.
Kaya, keep your eyes open and thanks for calling. Follow up with the hummingbirds, specifically the ruby throated, are most common here, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. Bill in Oregon emailed us. He says, based on many years of observing and tracking the ruby throated hummingbirds at his flowers and feeders, Bill's last male sighting is usually around September 1st, plus or minus 1 week. Bill's last female sighting is usually in the first week of October, but has been as late as October 17th. Many years, he says, the last female ruby sighting overlaps with his first dark-eyed junco of the season.
Oh, very observant. Very good. That's great. Yes, as we get into September, this is when these birds are going to start moving out. And there has been this myth of take the feeders down because you'll hold the hummingbirds here, and then they're not going to be ready to migrate. And that story's been around for years. The fact is that the signal to migrate is the shortening day length. They're going to leave no matter what. And in fact, those birds that stick around really late, they may need that food as an energy source. So keep it up until you know that the hummingbirds have departed. So throughout most of September, keep those feeders there. The birds will take advantage of it until the vast majority of them have headed out.
Until they don't need it anymore.
Right.
Bill Volkert, our guest, retired wildlife educator and naturalist, talking birds this hour, and you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. If you've got a picture that we can help identify, you can email it to us, and we'll take a look here in the studio. Let's go to Carolyn in Madison next. Carolyn, hi.
I think he answered my question. I used to watch purple martins and flocking this time of year, and chimney swifts, and there used to be some kind of swallow that nested under the Har River bridges. There's still some of the mud nests that they made, but there aren't any more of them. They were here ever since I've lived here in 1960. Anyway, is there a chimney? somewhere in Madison where the swifts are swarming yet?
Good question. You can search online. There's a little event they call Swift Night Out, and people gather at some of these communal roost sites where the swifts come pouring into. Madison, Milwaukee, some of the bigger cities have got these old factory chimneys, and these are some really good sites where they concentrate. I just had heard about one, and escapes me where it was, and they said over 1,000 chimney swifts are coming there in the evening. Oh. This is the time of year, so take a look online. Just search Swift Night Out, and you'll see where there's a local event, and you can join people right around sunset and watch as birds come funneling in. It's really quite an event. But you mentioned about the decline of these birds. Now, swifts are not related to swallows, and but yet they depend on the insects that they're gathering out of the air. And we've got a number of working groups in conservation lumping them all together, what we call the aerial insectivores, the birds that are catching the insects out of the air. And that includes the whippoorwill and the nighthawk. And as we mentioned earlier, yeah, the number of insects out there has certainly declined, so that food source is no longer as available. Maybe some of the habitat for nesting, the old barns are coming down and being replaced with steel sheds. The barn swallows are probably losing some nest sites there. And we also don't know in terms of the pesticides and contaminants in the environment that the insects that they're picking up, if that's somehow affecting the birds as well. Mm. And these are long-distance migrants. So we also may have some, say, restrictions here on chemicals, not necessarily the neonicotinoids that we know are serious problems these days. But other countries to the south are still using other more harsh chemicals. They don't have the same kinds of restrictions. And this is where the birds spend the winter. Is that an impact? We don't know, again, what's all adding up, but we can certainly see the result of it. Yeah, the aerial insectivores have seen, as a whole host of birds, pretty serious declines.
So I've got the website here as wiswifts.org, as in Wisconsin Swifts.
Right.
And
yep.
I see an event coming up here Friday in Milwaukee near Pulaski Park, Saturday in Whitewater. Janesville has one on Sunday. And there's actually a Swift Week in Madison coming up September 6th through September 11th. And Carolyn, you sounded so sad. I wanted to let you know that the Madison Swift event where you are will be Saturday, September 5th. They still don't know exactly where yet because it will be determined by where the chimney swifts will be found.
Excellent.
So I hope that makes you feel a little
bit
better.
Yeah, I hope people turn out for that one. That should be fun.
And thank you so much for the call. So, yeah, there is an entire Swift Week here in Madison, and there are some swifts to be found, even if they can't be found in the same numbers that they used to be, which is, you know, that could make you sad. So thank you for calling, Carolyn. I've got a question here about the place that you spent almost 30 years. Sumner emailed us and wants to know if anyone who's writing up a history of the Horicon Marsh and the diverse bird wildlife that can be found there. Do we have the definitive history, or is that going to be left for you to write, Bill?
Well, actually, it's interesting that is a wetland, and certainly the largest in the upper Midwest, there's very little that's been written about it.
Yeah.
The Milwaukee Public Museum put out a publication. It was an old magazine called Lore back in the 70s. They had a focus on Horicon Marsh's history, probably about 30 pages and some photos. There was the book called Wild Goose Marsh, Robert Gard and Edgar Miller, and focusing on the time of the 70s when the Canada geese were really abundant, with a little history and framing that with some of the aspects of Horicon Marsh. And my good friend Don Miskey, who passed away a few years ago, he grew up on the marsh and interviewed a lot of the local farmers and hunters. And he did a series of newspaper articles from that, and he combined that as a book. And I was proud to be able to write the foreword for it. And that's about all there is.
Hmm.
I was fortunate enough to work with wildlife biologists, researchers, get to know a lot of the people who grew up on the marsh and lived there, and I collected a lot of information, and my knowledge grew because of them. And I wouldn't say that I enjoy writing. It's not a labor of love. It's just labor. But I feel an obligation, and I am going to be writing that.
Oh.
And I have it in the works right now. I'm not going to guarantee when it's coming out. People have asked me, how long is it going to take? Well, when it's done, it'll be finished. But I am going to be writing a complete or comprehensive cultural natural history of the Horicon Marsh. And I hope to tell that whole story from all the things that I learned from so many other people.
That's amazing. Sumner, I'm so glad you asked. So the book is on the way.
Yeah, and slowly.
it takes what it takes, and it is a solitary experience, and you're just sitting there alone with your word processor and a blank page or an empty screen. And
I'm only going to write it once, so I want to make sure that it's complete and I'm satisfied with it. I don't want to later on think, oh, I should have added this or that and try to do another edition.
I got news for you, Bill. Yeah. You're going to think that no matter what.
I suppose.
There's always that feeling that there could have been something more or maybe should have left something out. Yeah. That's the nature of, you know, making it happen. But I really am excited about this idea that you're writing the book, and it's based on everything that you've learned in almost your 30. There's nobody better to write this book than Bill Volker.
Oh, well, so, thank you.
Thank you.
That's
looking
very
forward
generous
to
of you.
It.
I appreciate it.
Bill, we've been talking a lot about what's threatened the bird populations around Wisconsin. One of the things that we haven't mentioned that I've seen in news stories recently, and it's what Daniel emailed us. Mm-hmm. He's wondering about the avian flu and what's its impact on bird populations and whether or not birds might be better dealing with this plague or becoming immune to an avian flu.
That's a good question. Now, the biggest source of that is, of course, the bird confinement operations, the big chicken, turkey, mm-hmm. and certainly in Asia, waterfowl. This is where these epidemics start to spread. And, of course, from there, they escape and get out into the wild bird population. It seems that certain species are perhaps a little more susceptible than others, and whether that's the physiology of the bird or a flocking behavior where it can spread among the population more readily. There's certainly been outbreaks, and it doesn't seem to be very indiscriminate. It's shown up in a number of different birds here and there. It has not been a major epidemic in a large, broad geographic region, but it's just adds another worry for, you know, the health of our bird populations, and even for bird banders. And I'm a licensed bird bander. Handling birds, they're also saying there. You want to be a little careful because, these diseases can't spread from there to humans, and we've actually got them in the hand. So with that, we are monitoring it. And the one thing to keep in mind, and this is something I learned from working with the biologists in DNR, is just because we see a sick or dead animal, that's certainly a concern, but we really can't conclude what that was until we do the necropsy, sort of the animal autopsy on it, to find out, is it an isolated case or is it something that is more of an epidemic proportion? And these are the things that we do, say, on our wildlife areas, especially the wetlands where we're concentrating ducks and geese. So we're giving them great habitat, mm-hmm. but there's also that chance that we're setting the stage for an epidemic outbreak and where something can backfire, where we lure so many birds into an attractive area. And then all
anything
of a sudden,
contagious is going to catch fire.
Exactly. Late summer, one of the big ones is botulism this time of year, which is naturally occurring in the shallow water. It's an anaerobic bacteria. That's always a concern. So we monitor those wetlands regularly right now, looking for any sign of dead waterfowl or other birds. And, of course, examining that. Then there's also a few other kinds of major epidemic diseases, Newcastle disease and a few others that are out there, avian cholera, things like that. So wildlife health is a whole nother branch. But, yeah, we monitor that as well and just try to see how birds are doing, both in the wild of things that periodically come up or things that may be new and emerging. And bird flu certainly is one of those newer ones.
So keeping your bird feeders clean, keeping your bird baths, refreshed on a regular basis. Those are small things I can do. Keeping your cat indoors, small things I can do.
One other one is also if you have any windows that birds are colliding into, do something with that and make sure that it's more visible to the bird. I always remind people, it may be only 5 birds a year that fly into your picture window. Start adding that up with everybody in your neighborhood who has picture windows, and all of a sudden we realize we've got 100 birds dying out there and something that we could easily prevent. So American Bird Conservancy website has some really good materials that we can put on windows to reduce that.
There's something we can all do on behalf of our beautiful birds of Wisconsin. Bill Volker, can't thank you enough and look forward to having you back as always.
My pleasure. Thank you, Lee.
Bill Volkert's retired wildlife educator and naturalist, worked at Horicon Marsh State Wildlife Area for almost 30 years, and now we know he's writing a book about it, and that's something to look forward to as well. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to WPR News.